of labour power. The surplus value generated in the process of production by the capital advanced, or in other words, the self-expansion of the value of the capital, presents itself for our consideration in the first place as a surplus, as the amount by which the value of the product exceeds the value of its constituent elements. The capital is made up of two components, one the sum of money laid out upon the means of production, and the other the sum of money expended upon the labour power, respectively the portion that has become constant capital and the portion that has become variable capital. At first, then, capital advanced equals constant capital plus variable capital. For example, if £500 is the capital advanced, its components may be such that the £500 equals £410 constant capital plus £90 variable capital. When the process of production is finished, we get a commodity whose value equals constant capital plus variable capital plus S, where S is the surplus value. Or taking our former figures, the value of the commodity may be £410 constant capital plus £90 variable capital plus £90 surplus. The original capital has now changed from capital advanced to incremented capital, from £500 to £590. The difference is S, or a surplus value of £90. Since the value of the constituent elements of the product is equal to the value of the advanced capital, it is mere tautology to say that the excess of the value of the product over the value of its constituent elements is equal to the expansion of the capital advanced, or to the surplus value produced. Nevertheless, we must examine this tautology a little more closely. The two things compared are the value of the product and the value of its constituents consumed in the process of production. Now we have seen how that portion of the constant capital, which consists of the instruments of labour, transfers to the production only a fraction of its value, while the remainder of that value continues to reside in those instruments. Since this remainder plays no part in the formation of value, we may at present leave it on one side. To introduce it into the calculation would make no difference. For instance, taking our former example, constant capital equals £410. Suppose this sum to consist of £312 value of raw material, £44 value of auxiliary material, and £54 value of the machinery worn away in the process. And suppose that the total value of the machinery employed is £1,054. Out of this latter sum, then, we reckon, as advance for the purpose of turning out the product, the sum of £54 alone, which the machinery loses by wear and tear in the process, for this is all it parts with to the product. Now, if we also reckon the remaining £1,000, which still continues in the machinery, as transferred to the product, we ought also to reckon it as part of the value advanced, and thus make it appear on both sides of our calculation. Footnote: if we reckon the value of the fixed capital employed as part of the advances, we must reckon the remaining value of such capital at the end of the year as a part of the annual returns. Malthus, Principles of Political Economy, 1836. End of footnote. We should, in this way, get £1,500 on one side and £1,590 on the other. The difference of these two sums, or the surplus value, would still be £90. Throughout this book, therefore, by constant capital advanced for the production of value, we always mean, unless the context is repugnant thereto, the value of the means of production actually consumed in the process, and that value alone. This being so, let us return to the formula capital advanced equals constant capital plus variable capital, which we saw was transformed into incremented capital equals constant capital plus variable capital plus S. Capital advanced becoming incremented capital. We know that the value of the constant capital is transferred to and merely reappears in the product. The new value actually created in the process, the value produced or value product, is therefore not the same as the value of the product. It is not, as it would at first sight appear, constant capital plus variable capital plus S, or £410 constant capital plus £90 variable capital plus £90 surplus value, but variable capital plus S, or £90 variable capital plus £90 surplus value, not £590, but £180. If constant capital equals zero, or in other words, if there were branches of industry in which the capitalist could dispense with all means of production made by previous labour, whether they be raw material, auxiliary material, or instruments of labour, employing only labour power and materials supplied by nature, in that case, there would be no constant capital to transfer to the product. This component of the value of the product, that is, the £410 in our example, would be eliminated, but the sum of £180, the amount of new value created, or the value produced, which contains £90 of surplus value, would remain just as great as if constant capital represented the highest value imaginable. We should have capital advanced equals zero plus variable capital equals variable capital, or incremented capital, the expanded capital, equals variable capital plus S, and therefore incremented capital minus capital advanced equals S as before. On the other hand, if S equals zero, or in other words, if the labour power, whose value is advanced in the form of variable capital, were to produce only its equivalent, we should have capital advanced equals constant capital plus variable capital, or incremented capital, the value of the product, equals constant capital plus variable capital plus zero, or capital advanced equals incremented capital. The capital advanced would, in this case, not have expanded its value. From what has gone before, we know that surplus value is purely the result of a variation in the value of variable capital, of that portion of the capital which is transformed into labour power. Consequently, variable capital plus S equals variable capital plus an increment of variable capital. But the fact is that it is variable capital alone that varies, and the conditions of that variation are obscured by the circumstance that in consequence of the increase in the variable component of the capital, there is also an increase in the sum total of the advanced capital. It was originally £500 and becomes £590. Therefore, in order that our investigation may lead to accurate results, we must make abstraction from that portion of the value of the product in which constant capital alone appears, and consequently must equate the constant capital to zero. This is merely an application of a mathematical rule, employed whenever we operate with constant and variable magnitudes related to each other by the symbols of addition and subtraction only. A further difficulty is caused by the original form of the variable capital. In our example, incremented capital equals £410 constant capital plus £90 variable capital plus £90 surplus value. But £90 is a given, and therefore a constant quantity. Hence it appears absurd to treat it as a variable. But in fact, the term £90 variable is here merely a symbol to show that this value undergoes a process. The portion of the capital invested in the purchase of labour power is a definite quantity of materialised labour, a constant value like the value of the labour power purchased. But in the process of production, the place of the £90 is taken by the labour power in action. Dead labour is replaced by living labour. Something stagnant by something flowing, a constant by a variable. The result is the reproduction of variable capital plus an increment. From the point of view, then, of capitalist production, the whole process appears as the spontaneous variation of the originally constant value, which is transformed into labour power. Both the process and its result appear to be owing to this value. If, therefore, such expressions as £90 variable capital or so much self-expanding value appear contradictory, this is only because they bring to the surface a contradiction immanent in capitalist production. At first sight, it appears a strange proceeding to equate the constant capital to zero. Yet it is what we do every day. If, for example, we wish to calculate the amount of England's profits from the cotton industry, we first of all deduct the sums paid for cotton to the United States, India, Egypt, and other countries. In other words, the value of the capital that merely reappears in the value of the product is put equal to zero. Of course, the ratio of surplus value, not only to that portion of the capital from which it immediately springs and whose change of values it represents, but also to the sum total of the capital advanced, is economically of very great importance. We shall, therefore, in the third book, treat of this ratio exhaustively. In order to enable one portion of a capital to expand its value by being converted into labour power, it is necessary that another portion be converted into means of production. In order that variable capital may perform its function, constant capital must be advanced in proper proportion, a proportion given by the special technical conditions of each labour process. The circumstance, however, that retorts and other vessels are necessary to a chemical process does not compel the chemist to notice them in the result of his analysis. If we look at the means of production in their relation to the creation of value and to the variation in the quantity of value, apart from anything else, they appear simply as the material in which labour power, the value creator, incorporates itself. Neither the nature nor the value of this material is of any importance. The only requisite is that there be a sufficient supply to absorb the labour expended in the process of production. That supply once given, the material may rise or fall in value, or even be, as land and the sea, without any value in itself. But this will have no influence on the creation of value or on the variation in the quantity of value. Footnote. What Lucretius says is self-evident. Nil posse creare de nihilo. Out of nothing, nothing can be created. Creation of value is transformation of labour power into labour. Labour power itself is energy transferred to a human organism by means of nourishing matter. End of footnote. In the first place, then, we equate the constant capital to zero. The capital advanced is consequently reduced from constant capital plus variable capital to variable capital. And instead of the value of the product, constant capital plus variable capital plus S, we have now the value produced, variable capital plus S. Given the new value produced equals £180, which sum consequently represents the whole labour expended during the process, then, subtracting from it £90, the value of the variable capital, we have remaining £90, the amount of the surplus value. This sum of £90, or S, expresses the absolute quantity of surplus value produced. The relative quantity produced, or the increase per cent, of the variable capital, is determined, it is plain, by the ratio of the surplus value to the variable capital, or is expressed by S over V, where V is the variable capital. In our example, this ratio is 90 over 90, which gives an increase of 100%. This relative increase in the value of the variable capital, or the relative magnitude of the surplus value, I call the rate of surplus value. Footnote. In the same way that the English use the terms rate of profit, rate of interest. We shall see, in Book 3, that the rate of profit is no mystery so soon as we know the laws of surplus value. If we reverse the process, we cannot comprehend either the one or the other. End of footnote. We have seen that the labourer, during one portion of the labour process, produces only the value of his labour power, that is, the value of his means of subsistence. Now, since his work forms part of a system based on the social division of labour, he does not directly produce the actual necessaries which he himself consumes. He produces instead a particular commodity, yarn for example, whose value is equal to the value of those necessaries or of the money with which they can be bought. The portion of his day's labour devoted to this purpose will be greater or less in proportion to the value of the necessaries that he daily requires on an average, or, what amounts to the same thing, in proportion to the labour time required on an average to produce them. If the value of those necessaries represent on an average the expenditure of 6 hours' labour, the workman must on average work for 6 hours to produce that value. If instead of working for the capitalist he worked independently on his own account, he would, other things being equal, still be obliged to labour for the same number of hours in order to produce the value of his labour power, and thereby to gain the means of subsistence necessary for his conservation or continued reproduction. But as we have seen, during that portion of his day's labour in which he produces the value of his labour power, say 3 shillings, he produces only an equivalent for the value of his labour power already advanced by the capitalist. Footnote. Note added in the 3rd German edition. The author resorts here to the economic language in current use. It will be remembered that it was shown that in reality the labourer advances to the capitalist, and not the capitalist to the labourer. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. The new value created only replaces the variable capital advanced. It is owing to this fact that the production of the new value of 3 shillings takes the semblance of a mere reproduction. That portion of the working day, then, during which this reproduction takes place, I call necessary labour time, and the labour expended during that time I call necessary labour. Footnote. In this work we have, up to now, employed the term necessary labour time to designate the time necessary under given social conditions for the production of any commodity. Henceforward, we use it to designate also the time necessary for the production of the particular commodity by labour power. The use of one and the same technical term in different senses is inconvenient, but in no science can it be altogether avoided. Compare, for instance, the higher with the lower branches of mathematics. End of footnote. Necessary as regards the labourer, because independent of the particular social form of his labour. necessary as regards capital and the world of capitalists, because on the continued existence of the labourer depends their existence also. During the second period of the labour process, that in which his labour is no longer necessary labour, the workman, it is true, labours, expends labour power, but his labour, being no longer necessary labour, he creates no value for himself. He creates surplus value, which, for the capitalist, has all the charms of a creation out of nothing. This portion of the working day I name surplus labour time, and to the labour expended during that time I give the name of surplus labour. It is every bit as important for a correct understanding of surplus value to conceive it as a mere congelation of surplus labour time, as nothing but materialised surplus labour, as it is for a proper comprehension of value to conceive it as a mere congelation of so many hours of labour, as nothing but materialised labour. The essential difference between the various economic forms of society, between, for instance, a society based on slave labour and one based on wage labour, lies only in the mode in which this surplus labour is in each case extracted from the actual producer, the labourer. Footnote. Herr Wilhelm Thucydides Roche has found a mare's nest. He has made the important discovery that if, on the one hand, the formation of surplus value or surplus produce and the consequent accumulation of capital is nowadays due to the thrift of the capitalist, on the other hand, in the lowest stages of civilization, it is the strong who compel the weak to economize. To economize what? Labour or superfluous wealth that does not exist? What is it that makes such men as Roche account for the origin of surplus value by a mere réchauffé of the more or less plausible excuses by the capitalist for his appropriation of surplus value? It is, besides their real ignorance, their apologetic dread of a scientific analysis of value and surplus value, and of obtaining a result possibly not altogether palatable to the powers that be. End of footnote. Since, on the one hand, the values of the variable capital and of the labour power purchased by that capital are equal, and the value of this labour power determines the necessary portion of the working day, and since, on the other hand, the surplus value is determined by the surplus portion of the working day, it follows that surplus value, S, bears the same ratio to variable capital, V, that surplus labour does to necessary labour. Or, in other words, the rate of surplus value, S over V, equals surplus labour over necessary labour. Both ratios, S over V and surplus labour over necessary labour, express the same thing in different ways. In the one case, by reference to the materialised incorporated labour, in the other, by reference to living, fluent labour. The rate of surplus value is therefore an exact expression for the degree of exploitation of labour power by capital, or of the labourer by the capitalist. Footnote. Although the rate of surplus value is an exact expression for the degree of exploitation of labour power, it is in no sense an expression for the absolute amount of exploitation. For example, if the necessary labour equals 5 hours and the surplus labour equals 5 hours, the degree of exploitation is 100%. The amount of exploitation is here measured by 5 hours. If, on the other hand, the necessary labour equals 6 hours and the surplus labour equals 6 hours, the degree of exploitation remains, as before, 100%, while the actual amount of exploitation has increased 20%, namely, from 5 hours to 6. End of footnote. We assumed, in our example, that the value of the product equals £410 constant capital plus £90 variable capital plus £90 surplus value, and that the capital advanced equaled £500. Since the surplus value equals £90 and the advanced capital equals £500, we should, according to the usual way of reckoning, get as the rate of surplus value, generally confounded with the rate of profits, 18%, a rate so low as possibly to cause a pleasant surprise to Mr. Carey and other harmonizers. But in truth, the rate of surplus value is not equal to surplus over advanced capital, or surplus over constant capital plus variable capital, but to surplus value over variable capital. Thus, it is not 90 over 500, but 90 over 90, or 100%, which is more than five times the apparent degree of exploitation. Although, in the case we have supposed, we are ignorant of the actual length of the working day and of the duration in days or weeks of the labour process, as also of the number of labourers employed, yet the rate of surplus value, S over V, accurately discloses to us, by means of its equivalent expression, surplus labour over necessary labour, the relation between the two parts of the working day. This relation is here one of equality, the rate being 100%. Hence, it is plain, the labourer, in our example, works one half of the day for himself, the other half for the capitalist. The method of calculating the rate of surplus value is therefore, shortly, as follows. We take the total value of the product and put the constant capital, which merely reappears in it, equal to zero. What remains is the only value that has, in the process of producing the commodity, been actually created. If the amount of surplus value be given, we have only to deduct it from this remainder to find the variable capital. And vice versa, if the latter be given, and we require to find the surplus value. If both be given, we have only to perform the concluding operation, viz. To calculate S over V, the ratio of the surplus value to the variable capital. Though the method is so simple, yet it may not be amiss by means of a few examples to exercise the reader in the application of the novel principles underlying it. First, we will take the case of a spinning mill containing 10,000 mule spindles spinning number 32 yarn from American cotton and producing 1 pound of yarn weekly per spindle. We assume the waste to be 6%. Under these circumstances, 10,600 pounds of cotton are consumed weekly, of which 600 pounds go to waste. The price of the cotton in April 1871 was 7¾ per pound. The raw material, therefore, costs, in round numbers, £342. The 10,000 spindles, including preparation machinery and motive power, cost, we will assume, £1 per spindle, amounting to a total of £10,000. The wear and tear we put at 10%, or £1,000 yearly equals £20 weekly. The rent of the building we suppose to be £300 a year, or £6 a week. Coal consumed, for 100 horsepower indicated at £4 of coal per horsepower per hour during 60 hours, and inclusive of that consumed in heating the mill, 11 tons a week at 8 shillings and sixpence a ton, amounts to about £4.5 a week. Gas, £1 a week. Oil, etc., £4.5 a week. Total cost of the above auxiliary materials, £10 weekly. Therefore, the constant portion of the value of the week's product is £378. Wages amount to £52 a week. The price of the yarn is 12¼ per pound, which gives for the value of £10,000 the sum of £510. The surplus value is therefore in this case £510 minus £430 equals £80. We put the constant part of the value of the product equal to zero, as it plays no part in the creation of value. There remains £132 as the weekly value created, which equals £52 variable capital plus £80 surplus value. The rate of surplus value is therefore 80 over 52, equals 153 11/13%. In a working day of 10 hours, with average labour, the result is necessary labour equals 3 31/33 hours, and surplus labour equals 6 2/33 hours. Footnote. The above data, which may be relied upon, were given me by a Manchester spinner. In England, the horsepower of an engine was formerly calculated from the diameter of its cylinder. Now the actual horsepower shown by the indicator is taken. End of footnote. One more example. Jacob gives the following calculation for the year 1815. Owing to the previous adjustment of several items, it is very imperfect. Nevertheless, for our purpose, it is sufficient. In it, he assumes the price of wheat to be 8 shillings a quarter, and the average yield per acre to be 22 bushels. Assuming that the price of the product is the same as its value, we here find the surplus value distributed under the various heads of profit, interest, rent, etc. We have nothing to do with these in detail. We simply add them together, and the sum is a surplus value of £3.11. The sum of £3.19, paid for seed and manure, is constant capital, and we put it equal to zero. There is left the sum of £3.10, which is the variable capital advanced, and we see that a new value of £3.10 plus £3.11 has been produced in its place. Therefore, S over V equals £3.11 over £3.10, giving a rate of surplus value of more than 100%. The labourer employs more than one half of his working day in producing the surplus value, which different persons, under different pretexts, share amongst themselves. Footnote. The calculations given in the text are intended merely as illustrations. We have, in fact, assumed that prices equals values. We shall, however, see in Book 3 that even in the case of average prices, the assumption cannot be made in this very simple manner. End of footnote. Section 2. The representation of the components of the value of the product by corresponding proportional parts of the product itself. Let us now return to the example by which we were shown how the capitalist converts money into capital. The product of a working day of 12 hours is 20 pounds of yarn, having a value of 30 shillings. No less than 8/10 of this value, or 24 shillings, is due to mere reappearance in it of the value of the means of production. 20 pounds of cotton, value 20 shillings, and spindle worn away, 4 shillings. It is therefore constant capital. The remaining 2/10, or 6 shillings, is the new value created during the spinning process. Of this, one half replaces the value of the day's labour power, or the variable capital. The remaining half constitutes a surplus value of 3 shillings. The total value, then, of the 20 pounds of yarn is made up as follows. 30 shillings value of yarn equals 24 shillings constant capital plus 3 shillings variable capital plus 3 shillings surplus value. Since the whole of this value is contained in the 20 pounds of yarn produced, it follows that the various component parts of this value can be represented as being contained respectively in corresponding parts of the product. If the value of 30 shillings is contained in 20 pounds of yarn, then 8/10 of this value, or the 24 shillings that form its constant part, is contained in 8/10 of the product, or in 16 pounds of yarn. Of the latter, 13 1/3 pounds represent the value of the raw material, the 20 shillings worth of cotton spun, and 2 2/3 pounds represents the 4 shillings worth of spindle, etc., worn away in the process. Hence, the whole of the cotton used up in spinning the 20 pounds of yarn is represented by 13 1/3 pounds of yarn. This latter weight of yarn contains, it is true, by weight, no more than 13 1/3 pounds of cotton, worth 13 1/3 shillings. But the 6 2/3 shillings additional value contained in it are the equivalent for the cotton consumed in spinning the remaining 6 2/3 pounds of yarn. The effect is the same as if these 6 2/3 pounds of yarn contained no cotton at all, and the whole 20 pounds of cotton were concentrated in the 13 1/3 pounds of yarn. The latter weight, on the other hand, does not contain an atom, either of the value of the auxiliary materials and implements, or of the value newly created in the process. In the same way, the 2 2/3 pounds of yarn, in which the 4 shillings, the remainder of the constant capital, is embodied, represents nothing but the value of the auxiliary materials and instruments of labour consumed in producing the 20 pounds of yarn. We have, therefore, arrived at this result. Although 8/10 of the product, or 16 pounds of yarn, is, in its character of an article of utility, just as much the fabric of the spinner's labour as the remainder of the same product, yet, when viewed in this connection, it does not contain and has not absorbed any labour expended during the process of spinning. It is just as if the cotton had converted itself into yarn, without help, as if the shape it had assumed was mere trickery and deceit. For so soon as our capitalist sells it for 24 shillings, and with the money replaces his means of production, it becomes evident that this 16 pounds of yarn is nothing more than so much cotton and spindle waste in disguise. On the other hand, the remaining 2/10 of the product, or 4 pounds of yarn, represent nothing but the new value of 6 shillings created during the 12-hour spinning process. All the value transferred to those 4 pounds from the raw material and instruments of labour consumed was, so to say, intercepted in order to be incorporated in the 16 pounds first spun. In this case, it is as if the spinner had spun 4 pounds of yarn out of air, or as if he had spun them with the aid of cotton and spindles that, being the spontaneous gift of nature, transferred no value to the product. Of this 4 pounds of yarn, in which the whole of the value newly created during the process is condensed, one half represents the equivalent for the value of the labour consumed, or the 3 shillings variable capital, the other half represents the 3 shillings surplus value. Since 12 working hours of the spinner are embodied in 6 shillings, it follows that in yarn of the value of 30 shillings, there must be embodied 60 working hours. And this quantity of labour time does in fact exist in the 20 pounds of yarn, for in 8/10, or 16 pounds, there are materialised the 48 hours of labour expended, before the commencement of the spinning process, on the means of production, and in the remaining 2/10, or 4 pounds, there are materialised the 12 hours' work done during the process itself. Previously we saw that the value of the yarn is equal to the sum of the new value created during the production of that yarn, plus the value previously existing in the means of production. It has now been shown how the various component parts of the value of the product, parts that differ functionally from each other, may be represented by corresponding proportional parts of the product itself. To split up, in this manner, the product into different parts, of which one represents only the labour previously spent on the means of production, or the constant capital, another only the necessary labour spent during the process of production, or the variable capital, and another and last part, only the surplus labour expended during the same process, or the surplus value, to do this is, as will be seen later on from its application to complicated and hitherto unsolved problems, no less important than it is simple. In the preceding investigation, we have treated the total product as the final result, ready for use, of a working day of 12 hours. We can, however, follow this total product through all the stages of its production, and in this way we shall arrive at the same result as before if we represent the partial products given off at the different stages as functionally different parts of the final or total product. The spinner produces in 12 hours 20 pounds of yarn, or in 1 hour 1 2/3 pounds. Consequently, he produces in 8 hours 13 2/3 pounds, or a partial product equal in value to all the cotton that is spun in a whole day. In like manner, the partial product of the next period of 1 hour and 36 minutes is 2 2/3 pounds of yarn. This represents the value of the instruments of labour that are consumed in 12 hours. In the following hour and 12 minutes, the spinner produces 2 pounds of yarn worth 3 shillings, a value equal to the whole value he creates in his 6 hours' necessary labour. Finally, in the last hour and 12 minutes, he produces another 2 pounds of yarn, whose value is equal to the surplus value created by his surplus labour during half a day. This method of calculation serves the English manufacturer for everyday use. It shows, he will say, that in the first 8 hours, or 2/3 of the working day, he gets back the value of his cotton, and so on for the remaining hours. It is also a perfectly correct method, being in fact the first method given before, with this difference, that instead of being applied to space, in which the different parts of the completed product lie side by side, it deals with time, in which those parts are successively produced. But it can also be accompanied by very barbarian notions, more especially in the heads of those who are as much interested practically in the process of making value beget value as they are in misunderstanding that process theoretically. Such people may get the notion into their heads that our spinner, for example, produces or replaces, in the first 8 hours of his working day, the value of the cotton, in the following hour and 36 minutes, the value of the instruments of labour worn away, in the next hour and 12 minutes, the value of the wages, and that he devotes to the production of surplus value for the manufacturer only that well-known last hour. In this way, the poor spinner is made to perform the twofold miracle not only of producing cotton, spindle, steam engine, coal, oil, etc., at the same time that he spins with them, but also of turning one working day into 5. For in the example we are considering, the production of the raw material and instruments of labour demands 4 working days of 12 hours each, and their conversion into yarn requires another such day. That the love of lucre induces an easy belief in such miracles, and that sycophant doctrinaires are never wanting to prove them, is vouched for by the following incident of historical celebrity. Section 3. Senior's Last Hour. One fine morning in the year 1836, Nassau W. Senior, who may be called the bel esprit of English economists, well known alike for his economic science and for his beautiful style, was summoned from Oxford to Manchester to learn in the latter place the political economy that he taught in the former. The manufacturers elected him as their champion, not only against the newly passed Factory Act, but against the still more menacing 10 hours agitation. With their usual practical acuteness, they had found out that the learned professor wanted a good deal of finishing. It was this discovery that caused them to write for him. On his side, the professor has embodied the lecture he received from the Manchester manufacturers in a pamphlet entitled Letters on the Factory Act as it affects the cotton manufacture, London, 1837. Here we find, amongst others, the following edifying passage. Under the present law, no mill in which persons under 18 years of age are employed can be worked more than 11.5 hours a day, that is, 12 hours for 5 days in the week and 9 on Saturday. Now the following analysis will show that in a mill so worked, the whole net profit is derived from the last hour. I will suppose a manufacturer to invest £100,000, £80,000 in his mill and machinery, and £20,000 in raw material and wages. The annual return of that mill, supposing the capital to be turned once a year, and gross profits to be 15%, ought to be goods worth £115,000. Of this £115,000, each of the 23 half-hours of work produces 5 1/15ths, or 1/23rd. Of these 23 1/23rds, constituting the whole £115,000, 20, that is to say £100,000 out of the £115,000, simply replace the capital. 1/23rd, or £5,000 out of the £115,000, makes up for the deterioration of the mill and machinery. The remaining 2 1/23rds, that is, the last 2 of the 23 half-hours of every day, produce the net profit of 10%. If, therefore, prices remaining the same, the factory could be kept at work 13 hours instead of 11.5, with an addition of about £2,600 to the circulating capital, the net profit would be more than doubled. On the other hand, if the hours of working were reduced by 1 hour per day, prices remaining the same, the net profit would be destroyed. If they were reduced by 1.5 hours, even the gross profit would be destroyed. Footnote. We let pass such extraordinary notions as are of no importance for our purpose. For instance, the assertion that manufacturers reckon as part of their profit, gross or net, the amount required to make good wear and tear of machinery, or in other words, to replace a part of the capital. So too we pass over any question as to the accuracy of his figures. Leonard Horner has shown in A Letter to Mr. Senior, etc., London, 1837, that they are worth no more than so-called analysis. Leonard Horner was one of the Factory Inquiry Commissioners in 1833, and inspector, or rather censor, of factories till 1859. He rendered undying service to the English working class. He carried on a lifelong contest not only with the embittered manufacturers, but also with the Cabinet, to whom the number of votes given by the masters in the lower house was a matter of far greater importance than the number of hours worked by the hands in the mills. Apart from efforts in principle, Senior's statement is confused. What he really intended to say was this: the manufacturer employs the workman for 11.5 hours, or for 23 half-hours daily. As the working day, so too the working year may be conceived to consist of 11.5 hours, or 23 half-hours, but each multiplied by the number of working days in the year. On this supposition, the 23 half-hours yield an annual product of £115,000. One half-hour yields 1/23rd of £115,000. 20 half-hours yield 20/23rds of £115,000, equals £100,000. That is, they replace no more than the capital advanced. There remain 3 half-hours, which yield 1/23rd of £115,000, equals £5,000, or the gross profit. Of these 3 half-hours, one yields 1/23rd of £115,000, equals £5,000, that is, it makes up for the wear and tear of the machinery. The remaining 2 half-hours, that is, the last hour, yield 2/23rds of £115,000, equals £10,000, or the net profit. In the text, Senior converts the last 2/23rds of the product into portions of the working day itself. End of footnote. And the professor calls this an analysis. If, giving credence to the outcries of the manufacturers, he believed that the workmen spend the best part of the day in the production, that is, the reproduction of replacement of the value of the buildings, machinery, cotton, coal, etc., then his analysis was superfluous. His answer would simply have been, "Gentlemen, if you work your mills for 10 hours instead of 11.5, then, other things being equal, the daily consumption of cotton, machinery, etc., will decrease in proportion. You gain just as much as you lose. Your workpeople will in future spend 1.5 hours less time in reproducing or replacing the capital that has been advanced." If, on the other hand, he did not believe them without further inquiry, but, as being an expert in such matters, deemed an analysis necessary, then he ought, in a question that is concerned exclusively with the relations of net profit to the length of the working day, before all things, to have asked the manufacturers to be careful not to lump together machinery, workshops, raw material, and labour, but to be good enough to place the constant capital invested in buildings, machinery, raw material, etc., on one side of the account, and the capital advanced in wages on the other side. If the professor then found that in accordance with the calculation of the manufacturers, the workman reproduced or replaced his wages in 2 half-hours, in that case he should have continued his analysis thus. According to your figures, the workman in the last hour but one produces his wages, and in the last hour, your surplus value or net profit. Now, since in equal periods he produces equal values, the produce of the last hour but one must have the same value as that of the last hour. Further, it is only while he labours that he produces any value at all, and the amount of his labour is measured by his labour time. This, you say, amounts to 11.5 hours a day. He employs one portion of these 11.5 hours in producing or replacing his wages, and the remaining portion in producing your net profit. Beyond this, he does absolutely nothing. But since, on your assumption, his wages and the surplus value he yields are of equal value, it is clear that he produces his wages in 5.75 hours. And your net profit in the other 5.75 hours. Again, since the value of the yarn produced in 2 hours is equal to the sum of the values of his wages and of your net profit, the measure of the value of this yarn must be 11.5 working hours, of which 5.75 hours measure the value of the yarn produced in the last hour but one, and 5.75 the value of the yarn produced in the last hour. We now come to a ticklish point. Therefore, attention! The last working hour but one is, like the first, an ordinary working hour, neither more nor less. How, then, can the spinner produce in 1 hour in the shape of yarn a value that embodies 5¾ hours' labour. The truth is that he performs no such miracle. The use value produced by him in 1 hour is a definite quantity of yarn. The value of this yarn is measured by 5¾ working hours, of which 4¾ were, without any assistance from him, previously embodied in the means of production, in the cotton, the machinery, and so on. The remaining 1 hour alone is added by him. Therefore, since his wages are produced in 5¾ hours, and the yarn produced in 1 hour also contains 5¾ hours' work, there is no witchcraft in the result that the value created by his 5¾-hour spinning is equal to the value of the product spun in 1 hour. You are altogether on the wrong track if you think that he loses a single moment of his working day in reproducing or replacing the values of the cotton, the machinery, and so on. On the contrary, it is because his labour converts the cotton and spindles into yarn, because he spins, that the values of the cotton and spindles go over to the yarn of their own accord. This result is owing to the quality of his labour, not to its quantity. It is true he will in 1 hour transfer to the yarn more value in the shape of cotton than he will in 1/2 hour, but that is only because in 1 hour he spins up more cotton than in 1/2 hour. You see, then, your assertion that the workman produces in the last hour but one the value of his wages, and in the last hour your net profit, amounts to no more than this, that in the yarn produced by him in 2 working hours, whether they are the 2 first or the 2 last hours of the working day, in that yarn there are incorporated 11½ working hours, or just a whole day's work, that is, 2 hours of his own work, and 9½ hours of other people's. And my assertion that in the first 5¾ hours he produces his wages, and in the last 5¾ hours your net profit, amounts only to this, that you pay him for the former, but not for the latter. In speaking of payment of labour, instead of payment of labour power, I only talk in your own slang. Now, gentlemen, if you compare the working time you pay for with that which you do not pay for, you will find that they are to one another as 1/2 day is to 1/2 day. This gives a rate of 100%, and a very pretty percentage it is. Further, there is not the least doubt that if you make your hands toil for 13 hours instead of 11½, and, as may be expected from you, treat the work done in that extra 1½ hour as pure surplus labour, then the latter will be increased from 5¾ hours labour to 7¼ hours labour, and the rate of surplus value from 100% to 126 2/23%, so that you are altogether too sanguine in expecting that by such an addition of 1½ hours to the working day, the rate will rise from 100% to 200% and more. In other words, that it will be more than doubled. On the other hand, man's heart is a wonderful thing, especially when carried in the purse. You take too pessimist a view when you fear that with a reduction of the hours of labour from 11½ to 10, the whole of your net profit will go to the dogs. Not at all. All other conditions remaining the same, the surplus labour will fall from 5¾ hours to 4¾ hours, a period that still gives a very profitable rate of surplus value, namely 82 14/23%. But this dreadful last hour, about which you have invented more stories than have the millenarians about the Day of Judgment, is all bosh. If it goes, it will cost neither you your net profit, nor the boys and girls whom you employ, their purity of mind. Footnote. If, on the one hand, Senior proved that the net profit of the manufacturer, the existence of the English cotton industry, and England's command of the markets of the world depend on the last working hour. On the other hand, Dr. Andrew Ure showed that if children and young persons under 18 years of age, instead of being kept the full 12 hours in the warm and pure moral atmosphere of the factory, are turned out an hour sooner into the heartless and frivolous outer world, they will be deprived, by idleness and vice, of all hope of salvation for their souls. Since 1848, the factory inspectors have never tired of twitting the masters with this fatal hour. Thus, Mr. Hovell, in his report of the 21st of May 1855, had the following ingenious calculation, he quotes Senior, been correct, every cotton factory in the United Kingdom would have been working at a loss since the year 1850. Reports of the Inspector of Factories for the half-year ending the 30th of April 1855. In the year 1848, after the passing of the 10 hours bill, the masters of some flax spinning mills, scattered few and far between over the country on the borders of Dorset and Somerset, foisted a petition against the bill onto the shoulders of a few of their workpeople. One of the clauses of this petition is as follows. Your petitioners, as parents, conceive that an additional hour of leisure will tend more to demoralize the children than otherwise, believing that idleness is the parent of vice. On this, the factory report of the 31st of October 1848 says, the atmosphere of the flax mills in which the children of these virtuous and tender parents work is so loaded with dust and fibre from the raw material that it is exceptionally unpleasant to stand even 10 minutes in the spinning rooms, for you are unable to do so without the most painful sensation, owing to the eyes, the ears, the nostrils and mouth being immediately filled by the clouds of flax dust from which there is no escape. The labour itself, owing to the feverish haste of the machinery, demands unceasing application of skill and movement, under the control of a watchfulness that never tires, and it seems somewhat hard to let parents apply the term idling to their own children, who, after allowing for meal times, are fettered for 10 whole hours to such an occupation in such an atmosphere. These children work longer than the labourers in the neighbouring villages. Such cruel talk about idleness and vice ought to be branded as the purest cant and the most shameless hypocrisy. That portion of the public who about 12 years ago were struck by the assurance with which, under the sanction of high authority, it was publicly and most earnestly proclaimed that the whole net profit of the manufacturer flows from the labour of the last hour, and that, therefore, the reduction of the working day by 1 hour would destroy his net profit, that portion of the public, we say, will hardly believe its own eyes, when it now finds that the original discovery of the virtues of the last hour has since been so far improved as to include morals as well as profit. So that, if the duration of the labour of children is reduced to a full 10 hours, their morals, together with the net profits of their employers, will vanish, both being dependent on this fatal hour. This same report then gives some examples of the morality and virtue of these same pure-minded manufacturers, of the tricks, the artifices, the cajoling, the threats, and the falsifications they made use of in order first to compel a few defenceless workmen to sign petitions of such a kind, and then to impose them upon Parliament as the petitions of a whole branch of industry or a whole country. It is highly characteristic of the present status of so-called economic science that neither Senior himself, who, at a later period, to his honour be it said, energetically supported the factory legislation, nor his opponents, from first to last, have ever been able to explain the false conclusions of the original discovery. They appeal to actual experience, but the why and wherefore remains a mystery. End of footnote. Whenever your last hour strikes in earnest, think of the Oxford professor. And now, gentlemen, farewell, and may we meet again in yonder better world, but not before. Senior invented the battle cry of the last hour in 1836. Footnote. Nevertheless, the learned professor was not without some benefit from his journey to Manchester. In Letters on the Factory Act, he makes the whole net gains, including profit and interests, and even something more, depend upon a single unpaid hour's work of the labourer. 1 year previously, in his Outlines of Political Economy, written for the instruction of Oxford students and cultivated Philistines, he had also discovered, in opposition to Ricardo's determination of value by labour, that profit is derived from the labour of the capitalist, and interest from his asceticism, in other words, from his abstinence. The dodge was an old one, but the word abstinence was new. Herr Rocher translates it rightly by Enthaltung. Some of his countrymen, the Browns, Jones, and Robinsons of Germany, not so well versed in Latin as he, have, monk-like, rendered it by Entsagung, renunciation. End of footnote. In the London Economist of the 15th of April, 1848, the same cry was again raised by James Wilson, an economic mandarin of high standing, this time in opposition to the 10 hours bill. Section 4. Surplus Produce. The portion of the product that represents the surplus value, 1/10 of the £20 or 2 pounds of yarn, in the example given in Section 2, we call surplus produce. Just as the rate of surplus value is determined by its relation not to the sum total of the capital, but to its variable part, in like manner the relative quantity of surplus produce is determined by the ratio that this produce bears, not to the remaining part of the total product, but to that part of it in which is incorporated the necessary labour. Since the production of surplus value is the chief end and aim of capitalist production, it is clear that the greatness of a man's or a nation's wealth should be measured not by the absolute quantity produced, but by the relative magnitude of the surplus produce. Footnote. To an individual with a capital of £20,000, whose profits were £2,000 per annum, it would be a matter quite indifferent whether his capital would employ 100 or 1,000 men. Whether the commodity produced sold for £10,000 or £20,000, provided, in all cases, his profit were not diminished below £2,000. Is not the real interest of the nation similar? Provided its net real income, its rent and profits, be the same, it is of no importance whether the nation consists of 10 or of 12 millions of inhabitants. Ricardo. Long before Ricardo, Arthur Young, a fanatical upholder of surplus produce, for the rest a rambling, uncritical writer whose reputation is in the inverse ratio of his merit, says, "Of what use in a modern kingdom would be a whole province thus divided, in the old Roman manner, by small independent peasants, however well cultivated, except for the mere purpose of breeding men, which, taken singly, is a most useless purpose?" Arthur Young, Political Arithmetic, etc., 1774. Very curious is the strong inclination to represent net wealth as beneficial to the labouring class, though it is evidently not, on account of being net. T. Hopkins, On Rent of Land, etc., 1828. End of footnote. The sum of the necessary labour and the surplus labour, that is, of the periods of time during which the workman replaces the value of his labour power and produces the surplus value, this sum constitutes the actual time during which he works, that is, the working day. Chapter 10. The Working Day. Section 1. The Limits of the Working Day. We started with the supposition that labour power is bought and sold at its value. Its value, like that of all commodities, is determined by the working time necessary to its production. If the production of the average daily means of subsistence of the labourer takes up 6 hours, he must work, on the average, 6 hours every day to produce his daily labour power, or to reproduce the value received as the result of its sale. The necessary part of his working day amounts to 6 hours, and is therefore, other things being equal, a given quantity. But with this, the extent of the working day itself is not yet given. Let us assume that A to B represents the length of the necessary working time, say 6 hours. If the labour be prolonged 1, 3, or 6 hours beyond A to B, to C, we have working day 1 of 7 hours, working day 2 of 9 hours, working day 3 of 12 hours. The extension B to C represents the length of the surplus labour. As the working day is A to B plus B to C, or A to C, it varies with the variable quantity B to C. Since A to B is constant, the ratio of B to C to A to B can always be calculated. In working day 1, it is 1/6 of A to B, in working day 2, 3/6, in working day 3, 6/6. Since, further, the ratio surplus working time over necessary working time determines the rate of the surplus value, the latter is given by the ratio of B to C to A to B. It amounts in the three different working days respectively to 16 2/3, 50 and 100%. On the other hand, the rate of surplus value alone would not give us the extent of the working day. If this rate, for example, were 100%, the working day might be of 8, 10, 12 or more hours. It would indicate that the two constituent parts of the working day, necessary labour and surplus labour time, were equal in extent, but not how long each of these two constituent parts was. The working day is thus not a constant, but a variable quantity. One of its parts, certainly, is determined by the working time required for the reproduction of the labour power of the labourer himself, but its total amount varies with the duration of the surplus labour. The working day is therefore determinable, but is, per se, indeterminate. Footnote. A day's labour is vague. It may be long or short. An Essay on Trade and Commerce, containing observations on taxes, etc. London, 1770. End of footnote. Although the working day is not a fixed but a fluent quantity, it can, on the other hand, only vary within certain limits. The minimum limit is, however, not determinable. Of course, if we make the extension B to C, or the surplus labour, equal to zero, we have a minimum limit. That is, the part of the day which the labourer must necessarily work for his own maintenance. On the basis of capitalist production, however, this necessary labour can form a part only of the working day. The working day itself can never be reduced to this minimum. On the other hand, the working day has a maximum limit. It cannot be prolonged beyond a certain point. This maximum limit is conditioned by two things. First, by the physical bounds of labour power. Within the 24 hours of the natural day, a man can expend only a definite quantity of his vital force. A horse, in like manner, can only work from day to day 8 hours. During part of the day this force must rest, sleep. During another part, the man has to satisfy other physical needs, to feed, wash, and clothe himself. Besides these purely physical limitations, the extension of the working day encounters moral ones. The labourer needs time for satisfying his intellectual and social wants, the extent and number of which are conditioned by the general state of social advancement. The variation of the working day fluctuates, therefore, within physical and social bounds. But both these limiting conditions are of a very elastic nature, and allow the greatest latitude. So we find working days of 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18 hours, that is, of the most different lengths. The capitalist has bought the labour power at its day rate. To him its use value belongs during one working day. He has thus acquired the right to make the labourer work for him during one day. But what is a working day? Footnote. This question is far more important than the celebrated question of Sir Robert Peel to the Birmingham Chamber of Commerce. What is a pound? A question that could only have been proposed because Peel was as much in the dark as to the nature of money as the little shilling men of Birmingham. End of footnote. At all events, less than the natural day. By how much? The capitalist has his own views of this ultima thule, the outermost limit, the necessary limit of the working day. As capitalist, he is only capital personified. His soul is the soul of capital. But capital has one single life impulse, the tendency to create value and surplus value, to make its constant factor the means of production, absorb the greatest possible amount of surplus labour. Footnote. It is the aim of the capitalist to obtain with his expended capital the greatest possible quantity of labour. J.G. Courcelle Sonnery, Traité théorique et pratique des entreprises industrielles, 1857. End of footnote. Capital is dead labour that, vampire-like, only lives by sucking living labour, and lives the more labour it sucks. The time during which the labourer works is the time during which the capitalist consumes the labour power he has purchased of him. Footnote. An hour's labour lost in a day is a prodigious injury to a commercial state. There is a very great consumption of luxuries among the labouring poor of this kingdom, particularly among the manufacturing populace, by which they also consume their time, the most fatal of consumptions. An Essay on Trade and Commerce, etc. End of footnote. If the labourer consumes his disposable time for himself, he robs the capitalist. Footnote. If the free labourer allows himself an instant of rest, the base and petty management which follows him with wary eyes claims he is stealing from it. En Lingue, Théorie des Lois Civiles, etc., London, 1767. End of footnote. The capitalist then takes his stand on the law of the exchange of commodities. He, like all other buyers, seeks to get the greatest possible benefit out of the use value of his commodity. Suddenly, the voice of the labourer, which had been stifled in the storm and stress of the process of production, rises. The commodity that I have sold to you differs from the crowd of other commodities in that its use creates value, and a value greater than its own. That is why you bought it. That which on your side appears a spontaneous expansion of capital is on mine extra expenditure of labour power. You and I know on the market only one law, that of the exchange of commodities. And the consumption of the commodity belongs not to the seller who parts with it, but to the buyer who acquires it. To you, therefore, belongs the use of my daily labour power. But by means of the price that you pay for it each day, I must be able to reproduce it daily and to sell it again. Apart from natural exhaustion through age, etc., I must be able on the morrow to work with the same normal amount of force, health, and freshness as today. You preach to me constantly the gospel of saving and abstinence. Good! I will, like a sensible saving owner, husband my soul wealth, labour power, and abstain from all foolish waste of it. I will each day spend, set in motion, put into action, only as much of it as is compatible with its normal duration and healthy development. By an unlimited extension of the working day, you may in one day use up a quantity of labour power greater than I can restore in three. What you gain in labour, I lose in substance. The use of my labour power and the spoliation of it are quite different things. If the average time that, doing a reasonable amount of work, an average labourer can live is 30 years, the value of my labour power, which you pay me from day to day, is 1/365 × 30, or 1/10,950 of its total value. But if you consume it in 10 years, you pay me daily 1/10,950 instead of 1/3,650 of its total value, that is, only 1/3 of its daily value, and you rob me, therefore, every day of 2/3 of the value of my commodity. You pay me for 1 day's labour power, whilst you use that of 3 days. That is against our contract and the law of exchanges. I demand, therefore, a working day of normal length, and I demand it without any appeal to your heart, for in money matters sentiment is out of place. You may be a model citizen, perhaps a member of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and in the odour of sanctity to boot, but the thing that you represent face to face with me has no heart in its breast. That which seems to throb there is my own heart beating. I demand the normal working day, because I, like every other seller, demand the value of my commodity. Footnote. During the great strike of the London builders, 1860-61, for the reduction of the working day to 9 hours, their committee published a manifesto that contained, to some extent, the plea of our worker. The manifesto alludes, not without irony, to the fact that the greatest profit-monger amongst the building masters, a certain Sir M. Peto, was in the odour of sanctity. This same Peto, after 1867, came to an end, a la Strasbourg. End of footnote. We see, then, that apart from extremely elastic bounds, the nature of the exchange of commodities itself imposes no limit on the working day, no limit to surplus labour. The capitalist maintains his rights as purchaser when he tries to make the working day as long as possible, and to make, whenever possible, 2 working days out of one. On the other hand, the peculiar nature of the commodity sold implies a limit to its consumption by the purchaser, and the labourer maintains his right as seller when he wishes to reduce the working day to one of definite normal duration. There is here, therefore, an antimony, right against right, both equally bearing the seal of the law of exchanges. Between equal rights, force decides. Hence is it that in the history of capitalist production, the determination of what is a working day presents itself as the result of a struggle between collective capital, that is, the class of capitalists, and collective labour, that is, the working class. Section 2. The Greed for Surplus Labour, Manufacturer and Boyard. Capital has not invented surplus labour. Wherever a part of society possesses the monopoly of the means of production, the labourer, free or not free, must add to the working time necessary for his own maintenance an extra working time in order to produce the means of subsistence for the owners of the means of production. Footnote: those who labour in reality feed both the pensioners, called the rich, and themselves. Edmund Burke. End of footnote. Whether this proprietor be the Athenian well-to-do man, Etruscan theocrat, Roman citizen, Norman baron, American slave owner, Wallachian boyard, modern landlord, or capitalist. Footnote. Niebuhr, in his Roman History, says very naively, "It is evident that works like the Etruscan, which in their ruins astound us, presuppose in little states lords and vassals." Sismondi says far more to the purpose, that Brussels lace presupposes wage lords and wage slaves. End of footnote. It is, however, clear that in any given economic formation of society, where not the exchange value but the use value of the product predominates, surplus labour will be limited by a given set of wants, which may be greater or less, and that here no boundless thirst for surplus labour arises from the nature of the production itself. Hence, in antiquity, overwork becomes horrible only when the object is to obtain exchange value in its specific independent money form, in the production of gold and silver. Compulsory working to death is here the recognised form of overwork. Only read Diodorus Siculus, footnote. One cannot see these unfortunates, in the gold mines between Egypt, Ethiopia, and Arabia, who cannot even have their bodies clean, or their nakedness clothed, without pitying their miserable lot. There is no indulgence, no forbearance for the sick, the feeble, the aged, for woman's weakness. All must, forced by blows, work on until death puts an end to their sufferings and their distress. Diodorus. End of footnote. Still, these are exceptions in antiquity. But as soon as people, whose production still moves within the lower forms of slave labour, corvée labour, etc., are drawn into the whirlpool of an international market dominated by the capitalistic mode of production, the sale of their products for export becoming their principal interest, the civil horrors of overwork are grafted onto the barbaric horrors of slavery, serfdom, etc. Hence the Negro labour in the southern states of the American Union preserved something of a patriarchal character so long as production was chiefly directed to immediate local consumption. But in proportion, as the export of cotton became of vital interest to these states, the overworking of the Negro, and sometimes the using up of his life in 7 years of labour, became a factor in a calculated and calculating system. It was no longer a question of obtaining from him a certain quantity of useful products. It was now a question of production of surplus labour itself. So it was with the corvée, for example, in the Danubian principalities, now Romania. The comparison of the greed for surplus labour in the Danubian principalities with the same greed in English factories has a special interest, because surplus labour in the corvée has an independent and palpable form. Suppose the working day consists of 6 hours of necessary labour and 6 hours of surplus labour. Then the free labourer gives the capitalist every week 6 times 6, or 36, hours of surplus labour. It is the same as if he worked 3 days in the week for himself, and 3 days in the week gratis for the capitalist. But this is not evident on the surface. Surplus labour and necessary labour glide one into the other. I can, therefore, express the same relationship by saying, for example, that the labourer in every minute works 30 seconds for himself and 30 for the capitalist, etc. It is otherwise with the corvée. The necessary labour which the Wallachian peasant does for his own maintenance is distinctly marked off from his surplus labour on behalf of the boyard. The one he does on his own field, the other on the seigneurial estate. Both parts of the labour time exist, therefore, independently, side by side, one with the other. In the corvée, the surplus labour is accurately marked off from the necessary labour. This, however, can make no difference with regard to the quantitative relation of surplus labour to necessary labour. 3 days surplus labour in the week remain 3 days that yield no equivalent to the labourer himself, whether it be called corvée or wage labour. But in the capitalist, the greed for surplus labour appears in the straining after an unlimited extension of the working day. In the boyard, more simply, in a direct hunting after days of corvée. Footnote. That which follows refers to the situation in the Romanian provinces before the change effected since the Crimean War. End of footnote. In the Danubian principalities, the corvée was mixed up with rents in kind and other appurtenances of bondage, but it formed the most important tribute paid to the ruling class. Where this was the case, the corvée rarely arose from serfdom. Serfdom much more frequently, on the other hand, took origin from the corvée. Footnote. This holds likewise for Germany, and especially for Prussia east of the Elbe. In the 15th century, the German peasant was nearly everywhere a man who, while subject to certain rents paid in produce and labour, was otherwise at least practically free. The German colonists in Brandenburg, Pomerania, Silesia, and eastern Prussia were even legally acknowledged as free men. The victory of the nobility in the Peasants' War put an end to that. Not only were the conquered South German peasants again enslaved. From the middle of the 16th century, the peasants of eastern Prussia, Brandenburg, Pomerania, and Silesia, and soon after, the free peasants of Schleswig-Holstein were degraded to the condition of serfs. Moray, Fraunhofer, Meitzen, Der Boden des Preußischen Staats, Hansen, Leibeigenschaft in Schleswig-Holstein. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. This is what took place in the Romanian provinces. Their original mode of production was based on community of the soil, but not in the Slavonic or Indian form. Part of the land was cultivated in severalty as freehold by the members of the community. Another part, ago publicus, was cultivated by them in common. The products of this common labour serve partly as a reserve fund against bad harvests and other accidents, partly as a public store for providing the costs of war, religion, and other common expenses. In course of time, military and clerical dignitaries usurped, along with the common land, the labour spent upon it. The labour of the free peasants on their common land was transformed into corvée for the thieves of the common land. This corvée soon developed into a servile relationship, existing in point of fact, not in point of law, until Russia, the liberator of the world, made it legal under pretense of abolishing serfdom. The code of the corvée, which the Russian general Kislev proclaimed in 1831, was of course dictated by the boyards themselves. Thus Russia conquered with one blow the magnates of the Danubian provinces, and the applause of liberal cretins throughout Europe. According to the Règlement Organique, as this code of the corvée is called, every Wallachian peasant owes to the so-called landlord, besides a mass of detailed payments in kind, 1. 12 days of general labour, 2. 1 day of field labour, 3. 1 day of wood-carrying, in all 14 days in the year. With deep insight into political economy, however, the working day is not taken in its ordinary sense, but as the working day necessary to the production of an average daily product, and that average daily product is determined in so crafty a way that no cyclops would be done with it in 24 hours. In dry words, the règlement itself declares with true Russian irony that by 12 working days one must understand the product of the manual labour of 36 days, by 1 day of field labour,